Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Tech companies in 2018 reported a record 45 million depictions of child sexual abuse online. The incidents involved children of all ages, including infants, and the images often involved torture. The increase comes despite a 2008 law intended to fund state and regional investigations into online child sexual abuse. Since then, Congress has routinely underfunded and mostly ignored the program, while law enforcement and tech companies struggle to even hold the line, according to a New York Times investigation. Michael Keller is part of the New York Times reporting team that covered the issue. He covers artificial intelligence, algorithms, robots, and technology, and he joins us by Skype. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
A decade ago, fewer than a million images were reporting. Is the reporting getting better, or is the problem getting that much worse?
Yeah, we spoke with a number of people about this, and it's really a confluence of different factors. I think from the common sense, a decade ago, there were fewer people using the internet. It was also much more difficult to take photos and share them. Now you have a smartphone in your pocket, you have a camera that can take pictures and video, sharing them is effortless. The other big factor, as you mentioned, companies have increased their detection and automated scanning for this material. So you are seeing more reports that are come from the companies proactively looking for this this illegal imagery. But we also found another important dynamic at play, which was somewhat disturbing, in that the online spaces themselves create, you know, so-called communities where offenders can gather, share information. They normalize this type of sexual interest in children and encourage one another to partake in new abuse. So it's both that there is more people using the internet, it's easier, but that people are also finding ways to connect and encouraging one another to carry out abuse on children.
There are some communities that in order to be a member of them, you have to commit the crime yourself.
Right. They'll require people to take pictures of children holding up signs, sometimes showing the names of the group or other proof that it is newly produced in order to gain access to sites that are then sharing other material, including older material. So it's not just that, you know, images go online and that's, you know, the end of it. People say it's not just images. The access and the desire to view these images can incentivize new abuse.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We are talking about the incidents and the response to the depictions of child sexual abuse online. My guest is Michael Keller. He's a reporter for the New York Times. He covers artificial intelligence, algorithms, robots, and technology, and is part of a team that has reported on the issue of child sex abuse. Tech companies in 2018 reported a record 45 million depictions of child sexual abuse online. We'll post a link to the article. It can be very, very troubling, but it's super important. The incidents involve children of all ages, including infants, and the images often involve torture. Has this ratcheted up the violent nature? Obviously, sex assault is in and of itself violent, but when I was reading about it, it is shocking, Michael Keller.
Yes. People spoke to us that the violence depicted in the age of the children for many years has been extreme and has been very young, but people have also said that because of the nature of these online groups that can radicalize individuals and because of the perceived anonymity that spaces such as the dark web or using encrypted platforms can promote, people are more comfortable in requesting or seeking out more extreme forms of abuse. As one law enforcement officer quoted to us, they say, you know, back in the 90s, you wouldn't go to a back market alley and say, you know, I want real hardcore videos with three-year-olds. But today, in some places online, people do feel comfortable saying that.
You reported that someone in your article said that these abusers are on the cutting edge of technology. Why is law enforcement behind those times?
One of the main things that we found in our reporting was that, as you mentioned at the beginning, most of the state and local groups that are tasked with dealing with this crime are under-resourced, understaffed. According to a 2008 law, the Protect Our Children Act, The goal was to give them about $60 million a year was kind of set out, and we found that they've only gotten about $30 million each year. That's risen slightly, but the just amount of electronics it takes, the digital forensics it takes to run these cases, it can sometimes take 6 months just to track down and compile the evidence, get all the data, and when you're dealing with exponentially increasing numbers of reports of this crime, and each one is taking months to investigate, that's one of the contributing factors that law enforcement's facing.
You know, one of the people who introduced the legislation that passed in 2008 said they were unaware that it had fallen to the wayside the way it has. Is there a sense of urgency in Congress about this at all?
Just yesterday, we saw that Senators Blumenthal and Blackburn issued a statement requesting more funding. So that $30 million that I mentioned, they want to up that. And so there seems to be some renewed urgency. But there are further actions that the government could take. The other findings that we had from our investigation was that there were supposed to be national strategy reports published every 2 years, starting mm-hmm. in 2009, and we found that only two of those have been published in 2010 and 2016. And even of those, they don't contain all the required information. We also found that there was supposed to be a long-term national coordinator position, mm-hmm. someone that really oversaw the government's efforts around this. That long-term role has not been filled. It's been a 2-year stint, or sometimes even less, of people coming in and out, which some of the creators of the law say, the quote we spoke with Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who was one of the authors of the bill, said, this person is supposed to be the quarterback, and that seems to be missing.
There's no quarterback. And how has the Justice Department responded to this? Because it would be somebody who would work within the Justice Department, right?
Correct. Yeah, I think we're still waiting to see what the exact response will be in terms of the reaction from our piece. We know people have read it, and there's been discussion. That's definitely on our radar to see what will come next.
There's also non-governmental organizations that have been around for a while now. What are their abilities?
Yeah, the main one is National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. They serve as kind of the go-between between the technology companies and law enforcement. If you're a technology company and you find this on your platform, you submit a report to the National Center. They find out which law enforcement agency it's supposed to go to and route it. And we found that their system for doing that is rather old. It relies on technology that in some cases was started in 1998. They've received incremental upgrades from the technology companies themselves in many cases, but numerous law enforcement agencies said that they spend a lot of their own time reanalyzing the reports that come to them. They may have been misrouted, for example. Maybe the perpetrator had a local area code to, say, somewhere in Ohio, but all of their internet activity was actually in California. Mm-hmm. That type of separation and analysis had not yet been done. And they say, this shouldn't have come to us at all. This should be going to California. So there seems to be some improvements that can be made there as well.
I think one of the most shocking things, besides the abuse itself, was that tech companies, for a period of years, were letting their users know when they were going to report them.
We found this to be the case at Tumblr, speaking with former employees. When they were detected on an account, they would send a notice and say, we found child sexual abuse material. And in some cases, and the ones that we were able to document with police that were more recent, this would give the offender the opportunity to destroy evidence.
Yeah. What was the logic behind that?
We heard from someone that they thought maybe that would try and scare them in some way and try and deter them from this behavior. But we found that the relationship between how technology companies deal with these reports can be problematic in other ways as well. They can take months to get back to search warrants or subpoenas requesting information. Sometimes they'll respond and say, we actually don't have any information.
even when they were the ones that generated the complaint.
Exactly. Yeah. So in terms of the coordination, there also seems to be a lot of room for improvement there, to say the least.
So, Michael Keller, what are the tech companies doing to up their games? I mean, how are they dealing with this now?
So a number of technology companies have increased their scanning abilities. I think recently Facebook has done a good job in scanning for more material. I think this is something that we're going to keep looking into.
Facebook's also planning to encrypt its messaging, right?
Right. And so one of the things that we found was that they were by far the largest contributor of reports of child sexual abuse material. On their Facebook Messenger application specifically, they reported 12 million incidents last year. So it's 12 million of the 18.4 million total, which has many people worrying that if they move ahead with plans to encrypt that platform, those messages, those reports would by and large be inaccessible and we would never know about them.
Has law enforcement asked Facebook not to do this? I mean, has anybody tried to reason with them?
Yeah, that has been parts of ongoing discussions. Most notably last week, there was a day-long event at the Justice Department where they raised concerns about the company's plans to do this. And in a company-wide Q&A, Mark Zuckerberg, the head of Facebook, still pointed that this was something that they would be moving towards, encryption. He pointed that they would be working on other methods to put in place that could try and detect this material, even if it is encrypted. But the details of that, we don't yet know.
So what's the upshot? Is this just throwing more money at it? Because another issue that was raised in the article was that the people who do this frontline work for law enforcement, there's a high turnover rate because obviously even the little that you did describe is so disturbing. They're the ones in the front line that are seeing much worse.
Absolutely. And they are people that we've spoken to, nearly three dozen law enforcement officers that work with this crime type, as they call it. Mm-hmm. And they are extremely dedicated and it is difficult work. There is high turnover among these teams. Which results in increased training. But people pointed to us over and over again that, yes, there do need to be more resources, but education is a key part of it, educating children, educating adults that this threat is out there is also going to be integral to just reducing the number of incidents.
Is there any sense that this is a growing crime, that there are more and more people doing it?
I think it's both that our awareness is growing, that increased detection efforts are cluing us into a phenomenon that has always been out there.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, yes, people did tell us in law enforcement who worked in this area for over 20 years that there is a rise in production of this material as well. Going back to it's easier to take images and videos than it has ever been before.
Mm-hmm.
If you think about if in the pre-digital era you'd have to get your film developed at a camera store, which is obviously a huge risk if you have illicit imagery. And the other dynamic being that there are groups that will encourage people to go out and do this and say, oh, this is totally normal for you to have this interest, and here's how to do it.
What about survivors? Are they any help?
Are they any
help as far as the law enforcement end of this? Can they identify the abusers?
Definitely. I think that we spoke with a number of survivors for this story. And I think it is very difficult if you are a child and the people in your life that you trust, the adults, are the ones perpetrating this abuse.
Mm-hmm.
It can be very difficult to even understand what is going on or what you should do. The people that we spoke with say, the adults are, for lack of a better word, the adults in the room, they're the ones that are responsible. And it's not something that we can really put on a child going through this horrific right. abuse.
Well, Michael Keller, I will watch for updates on this issue, and I thank you so much for joining us to talk about it.
Well, thank you so much for having me and talking about the issue.
Michael Callery is a New York Times investigative reporter, and he's been investigating the incidents of a record 45 million depictions of child sex abuse online in 2018. They involved children of all ages, including infants, and some of the images, many of them often involve torture. We will follow that. You can read it for yourself. We have a link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. More Tech Tuesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
How do you turn what you love into a career? On season 2 of the Rivet podcast from WOSU, hear firsthand from students translating their interests into jobs without college. Listen to This American Graduate Project as we highlight the next generation of workers in the state's top industries of agriculture, insurance, and healthcare. Support for the Rivet podcast series comes from COSI. Subscribe now at WOSU.org/Rivet, on the WOSU mobile app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. When the Trump administration looked to repeal the Obama-era net neutrality guidelines 2 years ago, the topic attracted nearly 22 million online comments at the Federal Communications Commission. The problem is not all of those comments were authentic. The state of New York opened an investigation and now estimates that some 9.6 million comments may be connected to stolen identities. Jeremy Singer-Vine is the data editor for the BuzzFeed News investigative unit, which reported on the fraud. He joins us by Skype. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Ann.
How big of a problem is this?
It's a big problem for both the agencies and also for the people who've been impersonated. We focused in our reporting and our story on several people, specific people who've been impersonated. The main one was Annie Reeves. And Annie Reeves' daughter, Sarah, found a comment in her name online on the FCC's website. There were a lot of reasons why Sarah thought it was not an authentic comment, but the main one, sadly, was that her mother had died more than a year previously.
Is that mostly the case, that these are people who have died or they're stolen identities? Is this stuff that people are getting from, you know, the breaches that we hear about all the time?
There have been a lot of specific examples of people who have been deceased being named in comments or named as commenters. It's certainly not the most common thing. We focus in our reporting on one specific set of comments, nearly 2 million comments, that we notice a very strange thing happening. It doesn't explain all of the allegations of fraud in the net neutrality comments, but it was a very large chunk. These comments, almost all of them, used information that was exactly the same as information one specific data breach called the Modern Business Solutions data breach.
And that's where most of these identities came from, you're saying?
In this group of nearly 2 million comments, it certainly seems that there's no other way the information could be so exactly the same, down to little punctuation differences. Or punctuation quirks. They were letter for letter, number for number, punctuation for punctuation, the same as what appeared in that breach.
What do we know about who's behind these posts?
It's a good question. Well, we do know from the data we got through a Freedom of Information request to the FCC that these nearly 2 million comments were uploaded by a political consultancy called Media Bridge in Virginia. They had used a company called LCX Digital, they say, to collect the comments. We don't know exactly the process they used, but those were the two companies directly involved in gathering the comments. They were hired by political consultants further up the chain of political strategist and an industry group for the broadband industry.
And how do they respond to this link?
Well, the person who runs LCX primarily did not respond to our comments. The founder and owner of MediaBridge strongly denied having done anything wrong, strongly denied that there was anything improper about the comments he had uploaded. The Broadband for America, the industry group, did not respond to our comments. And the intermediary political strategist said that they had instructed their vendors to do everything above board.
Are there any laws broken? Are there any ramifications for this?
You know, I'm not a lawyer, but mm-hmm. the New York Attorney General has been looking into the question of fake comments in this proceeding for a while now. They haven't come out with any specific allegations, but as you noted in your introduction, they think some very large number of comments used stolen identities. The Department of Justice has also opened an investigation, and both agencies have issued subpoenas. So I'm keeping an eye on those investigations, hoping to see what happens.
Now, the FCC eventually has put the kibosh on guidelines for net neutrality, right?
That's right. They overturned the Obama-era net neutrality regulations in a 3-2 vote along party lines at the end of 2017. Those rules went into effect last year, and they were upheld very recently, last week, by a district court that ruled the overturning of the rules was illegal, but they also determined that states are allowed to set their own net neutrality rules. The FCC cannot block states from creating their own net neutrality rules.
To what extent does the FCC rely on these comments in their deliberations?
It's a great question. So the federal rules require when an agency opens up a proposal for comments, the agency take all the viewpoints into account. They don't necessarily, and they certainly don't, treat them officially as a vote. But certainly in previous proceedings of other agencies, they have been cited as evidence for one rule or another, one decision or another. What the government's supposed to do is take the viewpoints into account, consider them, and then make their own expert decision.
The comments that have been identified as fraudulent, did they have, you said that a couple million of them that you looked at, the reason why you looked at them is because they did have a common theme. Was the common theme pro net neutrality or opposed to net neutrality?
It's a great question. So in the proceeding overall, there were clearly fraudulent comments that supported net neutrality, and there were clearly fraudulent comments that were against net neutrality. The comments we happened to look at were comments that all opposed net neutrality, that wanted the FCC or advocated for the FCC to overturn the old rules.
How has the FCC responded to this?
The FCC is made up of five commissioners. There are right now three Republicans and two Democrats. The chair of the FCC, Ajit Pai, has been nominated by Donald Trump. He has defended the FCC's decision while mostly staying away from the question of the quality of the comments or the veracity of the comments. There has been one commissioner who's been very vocal in trying to get the FCC to do something. That's Jessica Rosenworcel. She is in the minority politically at the FCC, but has been calling on the agency to do more, both to figure out what happened and to protect future proceedings.
How can people find out if they're part of this online fraud?
Well, one way a lot of this came to light was people looking themselves up. And you can go to the FCC's website at the electronic comment filing system, and you can search your name or anyone else's name. You can search your family members' names, your neighbors' names, and you can see whether comments have been left in those names. And some of them may be real. Maybe your brother or sister or whatnot really did weigh in. Mm-hmm. But if it looks like something that they wouldn't have said, you know, maybe they didn't submit it.
And so then what's your recourse at that point?
It's unfortunate. This has been a frustration of a lot of people who say they've been impersonated. The FCC does not provide any way to remove comments. People
really?
Have asked. People have begged. Yeah. Their position is this is sort of a permanent record, if you will, that they've recommended to some people, if you don't like the comment that was made in your name, make another comment clarifying it. But people like Sarah Reeves, whose mother had been impersonated after she had died, found this sort of situation very frustrating and depressing in a way.
Mm-hmm. So the FCC isn't even marking these as fraudulent?
The FCC is not making any call one way or the other about the comments. They say essentially merely providing a platform on which people can make their viewpoints known, or in some cases, it seems like make other people's viewpoints that they don't hold, make those known.
Well, you know, it's one thing to be commenting on an article in a newspaper, but the FCC opens up the topic for comment. It's an official action, right?
That's right. And it's something that nearly every agency does on nearly every new proposal that isn't this is different than Congress passing a law, but when agencies want to make changes to their rules, they typically open up for a proposal. They have some period in which comments are received. They are, by law, supposed to look at them all. Now, they have tools for sorting through them and making sense of them, but they are really supposed to take them all into account.
So are there other groups out there, pro-democracy type groups, that kind of a thing, good government groups that are concerned about this, that have weighed in on this?
It's a good question. You know, on the whole, the attention to public commenting as a part of our democracy has been mostly the purview of experts and academics. There have been symposia trying to understand what to do in this new age of mass commenting.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not aware of specific nonprofits or organization groups that focus on the issue at large. There are certainly groups, for example, that care a lot about net neutrality that have focused very closely on this specific proceeding.
And then as far as what the state of New York is looking at, what is the expected process there and how they're going to go about it?
I wish I knew. They have been very aggressive in the last couple of years about digital privacy and the new digital landscape. They have an entire kind of sub-bureau dedicated to kind of internet and digital-related issues. I don't know what they're doing currently on this investigation, but it's been open for a couple of years now, huh. And I'll be very interested to see what happens.
What about the federal government? Has the Justice Department weighed in on this?
You know, all I know is that they've opened up an investigation and that they have issued subpoenas to a little more than a dozen entities. I don't know where they're going with it.
Well, Jeremy Singer-Vine, thank you for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Jeremy Singer-Vine is data editor for BuzzFeed News. We'll post a link to their investigative piece about how 2 years ago the topic of net neutrality at the FCC attracted nearly 22 million online comments. And of those, the state of New York at least estimates that some 9.6 million of them may have been connected to stolen identities. That's more Tech Tuesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Google employees took to the streets to test the company's facial recognition features, but how they went about getting test subjects is under scrutiny. Russell Holley, contributing editor for Android Central, is with us to talk about that and more. Welcome back, Russell. Hello, Russell.
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, okay. According to reporting, the tech giant went to homeless people to test these features. What's the significance of this?
Yeah, so Google, has been trying for a while now to get as many different faces as possible for its new facial unlock software to compete with Apple. And for a while was offering these $5 gift cards to people to train their faces on this, to kind of build the algorithm that was necessary to make it so that it was reliable with as many different people in the world as possible. And they started working with contractors to expand this base. Some of those contractors went into the streets of California and actually found homeless people and targeted them intentionally. For a couple of reasons. According to several reports, one was because these people didn't know what was going on, and so they were unlikely to tell someone in the news that Google was around taking pictures of faces. And the other was because they were unfortunately displaced, by telling them that California law worked in such a way that you could trade in gift cards that were less than $10 for cash, it was more likely that they would participate in this project.
What's wrong with this?
So many things. When it's a volunteer effort, when you're recruiting people who are aware of what the test is, then aware of why it is that you're capturing images of their face, then there are different rules. When you're saying, hey, for $5, I'm going to scan your face and we're going to use it in this thing, which is what was originally happening, then that's perfectly okay. But in some cases, these tests were presented as a sort of game, almost like a Snapchat-style selfie challenge game, where they were, taking pictures and giving them these $5 gift cards and not telling them what the facial data was being used for. And then targeting these people specifically because they were unlikely to understand what was going on is just morally wrong.
Did anyone break any laws?
It's not immediately clear that any laws were broken. There's definitely, the contractors that were involved in this, and it was stressed on several occasions that there were no actual Google staff members who were involved in this or encouraged this behavior, but the group that Google contracted out for a lot of this stuff doesn't appear to have broken any immediate laws, but it definitely started an investigation to see what can be done to make sure that something like this doesn't happen again.
I mean, we knew they were trying to work on their facial recognition programs, and we know that means getting as many faces as you can in front of the camera. I mean, why did they hide this from the media?
The biggest thing here is being able to stand on stage when the Pixel 4 gets announced in a couple of weeks, mm-hmm. Or next week, I should say, and be able to say confidently, look at how amazing our face unlock technology works. It's exactly as good as the thing that the iPhone does, which is not a thing that Google's been able to say so far. The facial unlock service that Android has is just plain and simple not as good as what's available on the iPhone. And so by being able to stand up and kind of confidently say that, it creates this leg up that Google can push and perhaps even one up Apple by offering some additional features that go along with this. All of that, if it's clear how it is that the company is doing this testing, it becomes easier for Google's competition to see, kind of roadmap what it is that the next set of features are going to look like.
Has Apple responded to any of this?
Apple has not publicly responded to any of this, but Apple has also been in a position of strength when it comes to its face unlock technology for a while. It hasn't mm-hmm. had any competition in this space to speak of.
Was this the only option? Is it going to make it that much better?
Yeah. So, this is definitely not the only option. Google could have made a conscious effort to more publicly open itself up to some of the things that were going on here. They could have gone to festivals and set up, public booths where they could have done things like this. There were definitely options. Uh-huh. I think one of the biggest things that Google struggles with when it comes to this particular setup is interaction with people of color. There are so many different examples of heart rate monitors and facial unlock things and skin scanning techniques not working the same way with white people as it does with people of color, because the testing was almost exclusively done on white people. And that's been a huge problem with technology in the past. And I think Google is trying really hard to make sure that that isn't a problem here. But the approach was just all wrong to make sure that's not a problem.
Has the state responded?
Not that I'm aware of. I don't know that California State has made any specific statements here.
Okay. Well, we'll see how this unfolds and see what the response is in a few weeks, right?
Yes.
Microsoft's folding phone. They unveiled the Surface Neo. Is it thumbs up, thumbs down, or to be decided?
Yeah, I mean, we'll find out. What Microsoft unveiled on stage was a laptop and a phone that both had a pair of screens that folded in half. Not in the same way that Samsung's Galaxy Fold does, but actually a pair of displays on either side that fold up like a little clamshell. And that's interesting for a couple of different reasons. One, we didn't actually know that the phone was coming. We only knew that the laptop was coming. But the big thing about both of them is that neither of them are even close to ready. These are extremely prototype things that were shown off at the event. There's very little of anything on them worked. And they're actually not even going to be available for sale until Christmas next year.
Whoa.
So this is a long time away. This was really just kind of a tease for something in the future that's going to be happening. And in the meantime, Samsung and Huawei have this kind of year to make sure that their software is continuing to work. But it's really interesting that Microsoft's phone is not actually running Microsoft's operating system. This is actually going to be an Android phone that has Google software on it. And as we learned during the event, Google and Microsoft have actually worked very closely together to make sure that the software on this is unique and actually does what it's supposed to do. Which is some problems that have been had with the existing folding phones is that the software's been kind of clumsy at first and didn't really work super well. Microsoft has really kind of made sure that it was very clear that Google is all about making sure that this phone works when it's actually available.
I'm trying to understand the marketing strategy here, because usually when you say it's a long way off, you're talking like a month. This is like an eon.
Right. This is a really long time for people to not only forget about this phone, but then buy something else.
Yeah.
Especially given, it's a year. This is more than a year that this will be out. Microsoft will have an entire other big Surface event to show off this phone at around this time next year. So I think that this was a big tease to show that, something else is coming, maybe to stop someone from picking up that new iPhone and hold on to what they've got. Instead of upgrading now, I think that when it comes to this time of year, this is when a lot of people decide that they're going to, make their next big upgrade. And so that's kind of a challenge is to get in front of people with something like this. But they also weren't super clear about when this phone was coming out. So a lot of people got excited about it during the event and then realized, a day or two later that they weren't going to be able to buy it, next week or anything. So.
For people out there, I mean, I still see people out with flip phones. I'm sure you do, too. Tell them why having a folding phone is good.
I mean, for people who have flip phones, there's really nothing to say here. This is definitely for nerds like me who feel like having one screen is just not enough. The advantage here really is being able to multitask. If you have... If you are someone who works from their phone pretty regularly, being able to have one full screen dedicated to what's happening on a web browser while you're messaging with people that you are in a work chat with or something like that, being able to video chat while giving a presentation is something that being able to remotely deliver a presentation is something that is usually very difficult. Or just having Google Maps open while talking to family members, so that you can kind of navigate while you're communicating. There are lots of different individual reasons to have this. It's really just going to depend on how well those things work. If it is tedious to do any of those individual things that I described, then it's not going to be worth it for people to pick up. And either way, this is not going to be an inexpensive phone.
Yeah. Yeah. It's going to cost. You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Russell Holley, contributing editor for Android Central. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Here's another phone, the OnePlus 7T. It's a smartphone. It's not cheap. What's going on with this?
Well, I think it's actually really interesting is that in a world where we're seeing, $1,000 Android phones and $1,000 iPhones, OnePlus is one of the companies for the last couple of years that has tried really hard to say, we are a company that's making phones that are just as good as those Samsung phones and iPhones, but we are several hundred dollars less expensive. And this is a continuation in that direction. The OnePlus 7T is a $600 phone, which is $400 less expensive than comparable iPhone or comparable Samsung phone. And it offers a lot of the same functionality and is just a really great phone for what you end up getting. The camera is excellent. The battery life is fantastic. It looks really nice for people who don't immediately shove their phone in a bulky black case. It's got a really
pretty
blue background, which I like.
Stop it. Yeah, go on.
Its only real flaw when it comes to, construction, this is something that OnePlus has not done for several phones, is that it doesn't have an official ingress protection rating. What that means is there is no official rating from a standards body that says how waterproof this phone is or how dustproof this phone is. So you get a Wi-Fi, you get an iPhone, you get a Samsung phone, that it is rated to be dropped in a puddle and left in that puddle for about 10 minutes before it has any actual damage. And that's a really useful thing to say. I have basically this guarantee from this standards body that's how this works. The OnePlus phones can't say the same thing. They promise that their phone is waterproof to a certain point, but they also don't promise that to a degree that it impacts their warranty. If your phone is water damaged by then their warranty does not replace.
So if you're a Butterfinger, second thoughts about this one.
It could be, if you know that you're very careful with your phone and you're looking for something that's less expensive but does not feel less expensive, the OnePlus 7T is a really fantastic phone.
It has Qualcomm's gaming-focused Snapdragon 855 Plus SoC or something like that. What is that?
SoC stands for System on a Chip, and it just means that's the processor that's inside of it. And this is one of the fastest processors that you can get on a phone today. It's designed to make gameplay really great by offering, the ability to play at higher frame rates. So if you are the kind of person who digs playing games, you will probably notice that things will look a little smoother on this phone than they would on, say, a mid-range Samsung phone. But you're getting pretty close to what you would be getting with a Galaxy S10 performance with this phone. But that's kind of the impressive thing is that you're getting that performance for $400 less.
The battery must be good, as you said.
The battery is fantastic. This is something that OnePlus has always done very well. It's got a nice big battery in it, and the screen is really nice, and the two of them work together to make sure that the phone doesn't actually drain in 8 hours, like we've seen with several other phones in this particular category. And a lot of that comes with just having a great big battery in it. This is actually something that Apple did this year, too. We're kind of seeing companies move away from making phones thinner, and instead focusing on having slightly larger batteries in them. And this one has a 3,800 milliamp hour battery, which is considerably larger than you will see in, say, Google's Pixel phones. Because the people who buy this phone, OnePlus knows that its audience really cares about battery that lasts for more than a day.
And you said the camera's great.
The camera's really good. It's actually three different cameras. And one of them, it has the ability to... very similar to the way that the iPhone is set up, you have kind of a main sensor. You have a sensor that zooms in a little bit, and then you have an ultra wide sensor, so you can get kind of those panoramic shots without having to move your phone around a lot. And each one of those three work really well. It is worth pointing out that there's no optical image stabilization in two of those sensors. So if you go to zoom in on something, you'll probably get a little bit of blur because hands shake sometimes, and that can cause some problems. But the ability to take photos, especially in low light situations, have been really good on this phone.
As far as what it looks like until people encase it in clunky black things, like me, what do we know about how many people actually, I guess, I'm trying, how should I ask this? How many people do that? I mean, is that pretty typical now, the people encase it, or do they let it go free?
Cases are something that happen with just about every phone. The most people take their phone out of the box and put it in the case right away. The question really becomes what kind of case? We're seeing a lot of phones that have come out, especially from Huawei and Honor and brands like that, but now also this phone and the latest iPhone, where instead of putting it in kind of the bulky black case, they're more likely to go and look for a clear case, so that it still offers the protection, but it kind of shows off that they've got, you know, kind of this fancier version of this phone.
Huh. Because, you know, it's a bigger deal than a car now, I would imagine.
That's right, yeah.
Mac is releasing new software this week. It's called Catalina.
Yes, this is the latest version of the Mac operating system. One of the coolest things about the Catalina update is it offers this feature called Sidecar, which means if you have a Mac laptop and you have an iPad, you can actually connect the two of them, and your iPad becomes a second display for your laptop. So you can actually take an application and just drag it, almost like you have a monitor connected, and have it run on the iPad. And the iPad becomes kind of this secondary display that you can poke at and treat as though it is a touchscreen, which is cool. Because Macs do not have touchscreens, and that's something that some people on this particular call really wish they would fix. but it's something that it works very well. And this is, you know, something that third-party software has operated a little while. There's apps like Duet Display that have offered similar functionality, but this functions much smoother because Apple's able to do, you know, some tricks that some of these third-party developers can't do. And it's something that you can get in a public beta form starting today if you wanted to go and download it. But, you know, if you want to wait for the actual stable release, it'll be out probably later this week.
Is there any way to prepare for this or just get a new, make sure you got the gear?
If you already have a Mac and you know that Mac is going to be able to update to the latest version, the biggest recommendation from people who have done this update so far is to make sure that you have a backup of your software somewhere, just in case something happens so that you don't have to completely reinstall from scratch.
Mm-hmm.
And backing it up is something that, you know, if you either have an external drive or you use something called Time Machine on Mac, it's very easy to do. But yeah, that's the biggest thing there is to go and, you know, clean up the system that you have right now, kind of maybe get rid of some junk that you don't necessarily need and then back it up and then you're ready to install.
Mm-hmm. I mean, is there a cutoff point for what systems will be you'll be able to update?
Yes, there's definitely a cutoff point. It goes back in most cases to about 2012.
Okay.
If you have a MacBook Air or a MacBook Pro or a Mac Mini that goes back as far as 2012, it should run on this just fine. If you have one of the newer MacBooks or an iMac Pro or a Mac Pro, all of those are already going to run this. But if you have an older Mac computer, 2012 is just about the cutoff for most of these things. And Apple has a pretty detailed listing on its website, but you can usually gauge by, you know, when you purchased the machine, when the machine was purchased or manufactured. I'm sorry. Which you can see in your system settings. It'll actually give you the year of its manufacturing.
So this is getting that two-screen situation that you like.
Yes, this is going to make, you know, being portable and having two screens a really big deal, which is something that I don't get to do very often, so I'm excited.
Right. Well, congratulations.
Thank you. It was made just for me.
Yeah.
I got a call.
They know you. They know you're out there. Russell Holley,
right.
Thanks as always for your help today. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
That's Russell Holley. He's contributing editor at Android Central. Make sure you like All Sides on Facebook and follow the show on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. You can follow me on Twitter, too, at Ann Fisher WOSU. I pop on there kind of on a daily basis. You should follow Russell Holley. Russell, what's your handle?
I am at Russell Holley on Twitter.
That's easy. At Russell Holley on Twitter. Thank you for listening today. This has been Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.